Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 324 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And today my guest is Joshua Lasteen. And Joshua is an entertainment lawyer in, imagine this, Beverly Hills, California. And his story is a little bit, you know, the kind of iconic Hollywood story, although it's a little different. A young man leaves the central plains of the Midwest, heads to Hollywood, or heads to California to make his fame and fortune, goes to law school at Pepperdine, and does just that, becomes an entertainment attorney, handling all manners of the business of the entertainment industry. I think oftentimes we think of entertainment law as being solely centered on agency, representing, you know, the talent that performs. But as you'll hear from Joshua, it's much, much, much more than that, many more opportunities. And of course, as you may well know, this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, as my daughter Bernadette is a performer, has been in Hollywood working and chasing the dream since she graduated from USC in Southern California. And so this is really kind of personal to me. So I had a great time chatting with Joshua, and I hope you enjoy that conversation. So without any further delay, here's Joshua Lasteen.
Joshua Lasteen, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's a great honor to be invited.
Well, that's very kind of you to put it that way, Joshua. I'm delighted to have you with us today. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah. So my name is Joshua Lasteen. I'm a solo practitioner in Beverly Hills, California. I run a boutique entertainment law practice, Lasteen Entertainment Law, where I represent the interests of studios, production companies, artists, models, influencers, and generally anyone who wants to create cool content and wants to be an artist and create new and exciting material. I've been in LA for about 11 years now. I'm originally from Iowa, born and raised in the middle of kind of bum nowhere, but came to California in 2010 to start my practice in entertainment.
Where'd you go to law school, Josh?
I ended up going to Pepperdine Law, which was strategically very advantaged for taking advantage of internships in entertainment here in LA.
For sure. The chancellor at my law school, the Catholic University of America, when I was there, left to become the chancellor at Pepperdine. This would have been in 2001 or 2002. So, small world.
Small world, though.
Yeah, and those of our audience who have listened to this program for a while also know that I have a vested interest in chatting with you, Joshua, because as my audience knows, my daughter is a performer, a musical theater artist, living the dream in Hollywood, or chasing the dream in Hollywood there. So this is near and dear to me personally as well. Let's talk about entertainment law for a second. We don't normally spend a lot of time talking about the substantive aspects of law on this show, but I think entertainment law is, you know, kind of something that everybody always has an interest in, because we, you know, have this fascination with celebrities and the industry, and you know, the intersection of that with law is pretty fascinating. Intellectual property issues, contractual issues. So give me kind of an overview. You said you represent know, studios and models and producers and, you know, all the above. In general, kind of how does your day flow?
Yeah. And so, you know, I also teach at Los Angeles Film School to undergraduate producers and entertainment entrepreneurs. Yeah. And one of the things I like to say is that entertainment is really about ultimately making a product. You're making a product the same way that someone, a butcher makes sausage or someone makes toothpaste. And it's really about ultimately developing that product, making that product, advertising that product, and then releasing the product. And so to the extent that, you know, entertainment is exciting and sexy and all of these things, it really is about kind of making the sausage. And then that's kind of where I come into play. Any entertainment project starts with an initial good idea, which needs to be bought, sold, developed, and produced. And I insert myself in the transactional deal making side of all of that conveyor belt. So my job begins when a writer or a producer has an idea. I help with the initial copyright process. I help with the initial shopping process. And when a project goes into production, I help prepare all of the contracts and forms to produce the content. So on an example for a podcast, you know, I would help write the talent agreements for hosts that come on to the extent that you have celebrity hosts. I would do the employment agreement to hire all of your production staff. I would do the lease agreement for your studio space to the extent you have them. So it really is kind of a wide variety of different deal-making types, depending on who I'm representing and whose interest is at the table. For a particular artist, actor, influencer, or model, I'm representing an individual's interest. And so I'm looking at very specific employment matters, how an artist gets paid, when they get paid, how they utilize their name, voice, and likeness. Does it have any conflicting obligations with other contractual responsibilities of the artist? What's the artist's obligation to the company and to the final product? And then on the flip side of that, when I'm representing the company against the artist, what is it that the company needs to protect in terms of getting the artist's work done? What happens, you know, in this crazy COVID world with the fluidness of all, if we have to change production schedules, last minute shoots, last minute getting equipments and people in place. So I would say that not one day is atypical. It's very interesting, the stuff that comes through the door. One day I'll be working on producing a television show. The next, a family member of a serial killer who's now the subject of a Netflix documentary, they're coming in and wanting advisement in terms of how to make a press statement on their family's behalf. So it is kind of a wide, expansive area of legal practice. I would say that, you know, within the entertainment industry itself, there's so many different facets of where you can insert yourself. The first step is separating between litigation and transactional practitioner. If you were paying attention to the Johnny Depp Amber Heard case, obviously that defamation trial is a very different area of practice than something that I do, which is much more transactional deal making. So now, probably a little bit more of expansive answer than needed, but happy to break down and digest.
No, it's perfect. So, you know, most people, when we talk or think entertainment law, most people's thoughts go right to Hollywood agent representing, you know, the stars and, you know, negotiating the contracts on their behalf. Your practice seems to be much more vast and touches on much more opportunities than simply representing the talent.
Correct. And so you have to think about it too. For every talent that's being hired and engaged to perform on a project, there is a company behind it. There's usually a set of entrepreneurs. Sometimes they are, you know, I wouldn't call them solo entrepreneurs, but a small production company, a small business, and they engage me to not only be their attorney as far as advising them on the day-to-day entertainment implications, but also to wear that legal hat to kind of be a sort of small business advisor as far as their day-to-day operations go. And like I said, producing film or TV is very much like producing sausage. To the extent that you have the same pitfalls of a small business, no matter what you're creating, NDAs, employment hires, general business affairs and deal making, employment law matters, all of that's going to be applicable to my day to day.
Well, it also sounds like, if we roll the clock back a little bit here, that your journey is not all that dissimilar from, you know, the Hollywood, you know, starlet's venture, moving from, as you said, the middle of the country, corn growing country, out to California to make their mark in the entertainment industry. So you go out there in a similar fashion, attend law school, and you knew you wanted to work in the business while you were going to Pepperdine?
Yeah, you know, I will definitely say I'm one of those do as I say, not as I do type people.
Yeah.
I knew very, very, very early on, probably in elementary school, closer to maybe middle school, that I wanted to be a practicing entertainment attorney. I remember when the Star Wars VHS tapes came out when I was a kid. If you fast forwarded to the very end, you would see all this really cool behind the scene footage and interviews with actual entertainment business executives that talked about the day to day aspects of filmmaking. And learning that as a kid from, you know, middle of the country, Iowa, that was so appealing to me to go out and insert myself in the cross section of business legal, but also with artistic creative endeavors. You know, I don't have any delusions of grandeur of being an artist myself, but I like to say that I contribute to the creative process to the extent that I help my clients create some really cool stuff. So that was always
absolutely
for me. I always knew I wanted to be an entertainment attorney. So this was all very strategically planned. I don't recommend that law students go into law school having a practice area predetermined. Do as I say, not as I do. This was just happened to be what I wanted to do. And I fell in love with it from the moment I started working in it. So
yeah, well, I would push back on that just a little bit. I mean, if you know clearly that that's what you want to do, I don't think there's any downside to pursuing your dream. Again, my daughter was knew from the age of three, you know, that she was going to be a performer, and she never wavered from that. Even though she was class valedictorian and, you know, a brainiac, she always knew she wanted to be on stage. And so I think, you know, there are people like you who know that straight off. So now you leave law school. Did you go work for another firm? Did you strike out on your own? Did you pound the pavement in Hollywood looking for any deal you could find? How did you break into the business?
So very aptly titled, like the name of your podcast, What They Don't Teach You in Law School. You know, law school is really there to teach you to be a great attorney first and foremost. And really, if you want to practice entertainment law, there's so much more of an expansive business behind entertainment, right? The actual day-to-day business of making content, you need to be able to wear both hats to know and speak the content creator side of things, as well as being a well-versed attorney. And so while Pepperdine is an amazing school in terms of preparing you for the legal aspect of it, it was really the internships in law school that I did at American Idol, Discovery Studios, Marvel Studios, and Starz, that kind of gave me a solid footing and understanding some much more of the entertainment jargon, if you will.
Sure.
In entertainment, we have 30 different ways to say the exact same thing. But it was really doing a mixture of almost full-time internships in law school, in addition to taking some particularized coursework in entertainment. But in entertainment, it's all about who you know, and it's all about networking. So when I first moved to California, I think in 2010, 2011, I got the phone number of my aunt's ex-husband's boss's wife's sister's kid, who was an attorney for American Idol at the time. And this was 2010, 2011. And she helped me get my first internship at American Idol doing music licensing and helping accounting pay back for those particular music, the songs that we used for the show. And funny enough, probably maybe a month or so ago, I had a young artist, a young musician talent walked through my office and she was being pitched for a new reality show by the producers of American Idol. And it just so happened that the attorney on the other side of the deal was the mentor who got me my first job back in 2010. So it's a very small industry. It's very much based on who you know and your connections. And like you said, hitting the pavement and trying to meet people and get deals made, not getting that kind of handholding or training at the law school proper.
Right.
If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you in part by the net profit CFO, Ryan Kimler. If that name sounds familiar, you might remember him as being a guest on episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, where we talked about his new company and how they can help you drive profit to your bottom line. I was so enamored by what Ryan had to say that I actually became a client. I called him up and said, I'm ready to take advantage of your expertise. And that's exactly what happened. So I'm now a very happy customer or client of the Net Profit CFO. But I'm also very pleased to welcome them as a sponsor to the show. So do you want to enjoy higher net profits without working longer or harder? As you learned in that previous episode, with just 9 simple numbers, Ryan will help you drive more profit to your bottom line, and he won't confuse you with all the details. If you want to increase your net profit, but don't like getting deep into the numbers, I highly recommend that you connect with Ryan. You can do that by going to netprofitcfo.com and download the Financial Clarity Dashboard. It's a great tool for getting the big picture of your financials.
Well, you know, like most industries, I think, you know, when we think of entertainment, we think of, you know, the talent, the onstage, the in front of the camera, you know, talent. But for every actor or actress, performer that's providing that art, there are 10 or 20 people supporting that endeavor.
Yep.
Behind the camera.
Well, exactly.
You know, in the studio. There's tremendous opportunity in the entertainment industry aside from being the talent.
You're absolutely right. I would say that on any given TV show or film, we have to employ at least 250 to 500 people between all of the assistants, all of the grips, all of the lighters, all the costumers, all of the set decorators, the actors, writers, directors, producers, obviously, to myself, the business and legal affairs who sits in the office and kind of plays Hawkeye in the nest, so to speak, and kind of calls the shots from yeah. Hollywood. There is a lot of people whose hands go into the work. And I would say that all entertainment is a labor of love, kind of a group.
Yeah. I'm one of those geeky people who actually sit through the credits.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of read them and just kind of, you know, here's the nutritionist and here's the caterer and here's yep. the drivers. And all those people, they fall into, you know, contractual arrangements, either through their companies or services or individually. And that's all business right there.
Right. And so that's a great segue into kind of explaining what I do. My job is to hire all of those people and make sure that their credits appear correctly at the very end.
Yeah.
So anything that the show or film has to spend money on, to the extent it goes in front of the camera, it has to have a contract and I have to review it and write it.
All right. So let's talk then about the whole business of being an entertainment attorney. So how do your clients come to you now? Do you just have a reputation that touches lots and lots of people in the industry, and when opportunities arise, they think of you and call you? Or are you marketing? Are you still networking? Obviously, you've branded your firm very cleverly and beautifully, I think. So tell me, how are you going about getting new business?
I think you said it best when you kind of make the comparison that entertainment lawyers, just much like the artists of Hollywood, are out here kind of, it's the same story. You're building sort of a brand to your name in of itself, whether you're an actor, a writer, or a producer, or even an entertainment lawyer. So I would say 95% of my business comes through word of mouth referral and through just general networking and contacts that I've made over the last 10 years. But that's something that really took a long time to cultivate. And it really, there's kind of this perversive joke in Hollywood that it takes 10 years to make it. I think it really was at my 10-year mark that somebody flipped on a light switch and all of a sudden the phone started ringing. Very first job out of law school was at the CAA mailroom, a very prestigious place to get your start in the entertainment industry. This was back in 2014. Fast forward almost 10 years later, all of the people that I worked with at the CAA mailroom are now executives in their own right, are now Hollywood deal makers, and they look to me towards advisement and the legal affairs and business affairs side of things to the extent that they're creatives and they have to navigate business affairs themselves.
Well, just another example of an overnight success that took 20 years to occur.
Yes. Yes. Right? Overnight success that took 20 years to occur. That's a great way to sum it up.
So, and then how do you run your business? Are you running it out of the kitchen, living there in Beverly Hills, or you have office space, you have staff that are supporting you, or what's the nature of the business of Lastine Entertainment Law?
We are, I don't want to say silly, but in the age of COVID, it is sometimes silly to rent an office, but we do rent an office space, to have that little degree of break or separation. For the first year, we operated out of our house, off of our couch, if you will, I've been in an office for about a year and a half now. We have a small support staff, a small social media staff, and we are in the process of bringing on some more associates. One of the things that I find very interesting, about the hiring process right now is it's such a hot job market that you really have to have interests completely aligned in terms of where you want your business and company to go and where your employee sees themselves, where they want to go, because they have opportunities pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, it's there's two and a half jobs for job openings for every person looking for a job. So you're right. You need to make sure that your interests align, because people have a lot of opportunities to go elsewhere.
It's definitely an employee's market out there, which is great. I think one of the things that kind of prompted me to start my business, the little kick in the boot, if you will, I was laid off during the pandemic. Obviously, a lot of the entertainment business suffered during the pandemic.
Sure.
My job specifically revolves around the physical side of filmmaking. Most of that was shut down for 6 to 8 months.
Yeah.
But that kind of gave me clarity, time, and bandwidth to open my own thing. And fortunately, with kind of the reopening of things, while the economy isn't super buzzing, entertainment is still obviously a very hot player.
So what are some of the tools that you use to get your job done? What are some of the things you can't live without? I mean, stereotypically, the Hollywood entertainment lawyer has, his iPhone surgically attached to his hand. But beyond that,
I actually don't use Apple products very strategically so that I can maintain some sort of air of being offline. It's really great. My clients will send me texts and they'll say, why do I get the little green .. And then I'm not connected to the Apple brand. I'm offline.
Okay. We won't hold that against as an Apple fanboy. I won't hold that against you.
That's right. That's right. And we're working on a show right now for Apple Plus, and Apple Plus is a great content creator. So we're obviously a big fan of them.
Getting better every day, aren't they?
There's this new prehistoric series on Apple Plus that my wife and I just started this past weekend that I really am enjoying. Tools of the trade, nitro brew coffee, and green smoothies are a must.
Yeah.
My examples and explanations of copyright. And really kind of my best friend in my entertainment law practice is IMDb Pro, which is kind of like the Facebook for entertainment. It's a paid version, paid subscription of the IMDb, the International Movie Database website. But if I need to find the contact information of any artist, writer, celebrity, or their respective business and legal affairs reps, their agents, managers, and attorneys, most of that information is contained on IMDb Pro, along with new casting projects. They kind of have a hot list of who's trending in social media right now. And then the Daily Trades, the Variety, Deadline, and Hollywood Reporter.
Can you spend just a couple of minutes talking about the influence of collective bargaining and unions in the entertainment industry, not just from the talent standpoint, you know, equity performers and SAG members, and although that's really interesting, but also, you know, the carpenters on set and the drivers and all of those folks, you know, some are in unions, some are not. How does that complicate, or maybe not complicate, how does that affect the work that you do?
Right. And this is kind of something of a hot button issue as it relates to, you know, us coming back to work post-COVID. The Rust shooting that happened with Alec Baldwin, unfortunately, tragically last fall. You know, there, like you said, there are so many people who are working on a television or film project. To the extent what we would call above the line personnel, above the line kind of meaning the guys that are in front of the camera or whose name credit appears at the very opening, kind of what we call the big wigs, all of them are going to be covered by collective bargaining agreement. But as you move down the totem pole, like you said, you know, production assistants and sort of the lower level rungs of employees may not be covered by those collective bargaining agreements. To the extent that Hollywood has always taken advantage of some sort of, you know, filming in a different territory for tax benefits, for taking advantage of a lower minimum wage, you know, that helps the bottom line put more dollars on screen is the way that we refer to it, right?
Right.
The more money on screen, arguably the better product. I would argue too that, you know, for every entertainment project, it is a labor of love for an entire team of people. All of those people should be well fed, well paid, and well slept in order to get the best product on screen as well. And so, you know, in this era of post-COVID, we have kind of a reduced work staff just by nature of the pandemic, and we have an expedited mission to create more content. We were kind of in a show hole, if you will, for 6 to 8 months when content was down and not being produced. Those are kind of paradoxical factors. We have less employees ever than before, but we have more content being created ever than before. That tends to lead to, you know, 12 to 14 hour work days and working 7 days a week. That's not sustainable over the long haul. And it doesn't create a very good end-all product, in my opinion. So as someone who kind of sits in between the middle of these tensions between the individual worker in entertainment and the large companies and the large studios, my job has always been to be kind of a vocal advocate for doing what is right, making sure that everyone is kind of paid, hopefully in line with where their quote is at, but make sure that the shows and the films kind of go off without a hitch and everyone gets what they deserve.
You know, and not too many people understand the role that SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and the Equity, I don't know, is it a guild?
Yeah, we call it guild, union, collective bargaining agreement. Again, we got 30 ways to say the same thing in Hollywood.
I think most people don't understand the role that those entities play in the market.
For sure, for sure. And the best way to explain it is with regards to the Writers Guild of America.
Yeah.
If I want to hire a writer who has been approved for membership by the WGA, the Writers Guild of America, they set a minimum standard in terms of the employment contract that we have to engage them with. So there's a set of minimum rates. We call it the schedule of minimums. If I want to employ a writer on a week-to-week basis for a particular TV show or film, I have to look up in the WGA schedule of minimums the lowest amount that I could possibly pay them per guild, right? That's what they their job is to negotiate that rate. That usually is a starting conversation because, you know, at this point, no one works for scale anymore. But it is there to protect the writers from being taken advantage of.
Right. Well, listen, Joshua, we could do this for the rest of the day. Well, I know you're getting started out there on the West Coast doing what you do best. Tell our audience, what's the best way to reach out to you if they want to find out more about the industry or maybe anything that you've brought up or maybe touch base with you? What's the best way to reach you?
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of me is either by my website, lastingimpressions.com, just kind of a play on the pun, Lasting Impressions. My last name, impressions.com. Otherwise, I'm reachable on Instagram at lastinglaw, just the at sign with lastinglaw.
Right. Perfect. Well, we'll have all of that in the show notes. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with me. I've learned a lot. Like I said, we don't normally cover substantive areas of the law, but I think that was substantive enough to give people an idea of what you do and how you do it and how you got to be where you are today. So I really do thank you for taking the time to share all that with us.
Likewise, and thank you for having me, and happy to come back and talk more anytime.
Let's do that. Thanks for being a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Awesome. Thank you, Neil.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.